This week, we get our drink on and our snack on. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you now. Ladies and gentlemen.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace Process.
We honor country.
A government can't control the economy without controlling people.
We will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
Ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
To remind America of the fierce urgency of now. 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 Now.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Now.
The Midwest.
Now.
Peace.
Now.
Process.
Now. Now. Now.
All right. Welcome to episode 31. The kids call it the process. Today is June 1st, 2012. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
He's Rob.
And if you couldn't tell, we are on location once again. We're at GC Food and Brewery. So we want to give a shout out to the fine folks here at GC and encourage everybody in the St. Louis area to check them out. They've got, it's a microbrewery, so they've got great beer and they've got good food.
But what does GC stand for?
Granite City.
Are we in Granite City?
No, we are not.
How does that make any sense?
Well, it's actually a chain that started in South Dakota.
They have granite there too?
Yes. But they were afraid that if they called it Granite City here, everybody would make the connection with Granite City, Illinois.
Same thing happened to me. Like I didn't really check out the website you sent, and then I did the day of. I'm like, oh my God, I'm not driving way out there.
Okay, so I'm going to give my little spiel here that I usually give to let everybody know how they can get a hold of us, give us feedback. Jeremy and Rob are going to get up and get another beer while I do that. So we have a forum that you can check out at forum.midwestpeaceprocess.com. You can send us an email, feedback@midwestpeaceprocess.com, or you can just comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/midwestpeace. You can also follow us on Twitter @midwestpeace. So that's how to contact us. Now let's give you something to contact us about. So I think Jeremy's going to kick this off with a question for Rob.
Rob. I want you to answer the question. I don't want any evasive theories or, well, what about, you know, Johnny Hume public?
I'm going to evade.
Smith, what is your list of approved websites or radio shows or radio stations where I can get my news? Because any time I mention a news story, you fire back with, oh, you saw that on Drudge. So, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. Lately I haven't been, because I've purposely been trying to find other sources just to get at you. And anytime I ask you what is an approved site, you don't answer the question. You're evasive. So I want to hear it. Where do you go, and where am I allowed to go under your world, your government, to get my news?
What? Anywhere but drugs? No. I've been thinking about my Drudge to play. It's kind of a running theme through the podcast about how I feel about Drudge.
I don't care how you feel about Drudge. I want to know what the approved sites are. Just start off by giving me one website where I can go to get my news.
NPR.org.
Why is that one better than Drudge?
Because all of the reporters have funny names. You got Mandalit Del Barco, right? You have Veronique LaCapra.
Yeah.
You have Eleanor Beardsley from France.
Oh, that doesn't hold up.
I think Eleanor Beardsley's voice is hot.
Give me a song. Fabia
Quisparty. I like Sylvia Poggioli.
Oh! Nina Totenberg on the Supreme Court.
Nina, I can get on board with that. But tell me why. Seriously, why? Why there?
How about a Fabia Quisparty?
Daka! Set it up. I'm not quibbling with any sites you would go to or radio show.
Are.
No, here's my issue, and I finally figured out why I quibble with Drudge. Say you're Jeremy Conservative, and you're perusing the beautiful internet or whatever media sites you are to get your news, and you find some issue, I don't know, about Slurpees in New York or whatever the case may be. And that might interest you or be relevant to your interests. I think that's okay. I think what I worry about Drudge and what Drudge looks like to me is some less intelligent conservative than you, Mr.
Don't
Jeremy.
Blake a.
Ricky conservative. I hate Ricky. Ricky the Rhino. You know, Ricky waking up with his morning coffee. His coffee's not sufficiently liberal, you know. Wouldn't wake up with his morning tea, would he? Nope. And no cream and sugar in Ricky's coffee. You know, straight black. No, are you kidding? No, just straight black in a styrofoam cup, because who cares about the earth? So Ricky goes to his computer and says, I don't feel sufficiently angry today. Something should make me angry. And where should I go for my conservative anger today? I don't know what it is. I mean, where's the site I went to yesterday for conservative anger? Oh, I'll go to Drudge Report. Whoa, the siren's spinning. What's it gonna be?
I love the Drudge siren.
It seems like a one-stop shop for conservative anger du jour. That's French for of the day.
Sacré bleu.
Most impressive.
That's right. And so when I'm on the site, it feels like I feel my conservative brethren around me feeding up the little morsels of conservative anger, feeding the urge to be angry. I saw the Slurpee story, I saw it on CNN, I saw it on Daily Show. I don't really have any trouble with the Slurpee New York City story. So, and the fact that you knew about the Slurpee story.
I heard about it on The Point.
Right.
Woody and Rizzuto. That is the farthest thing from a conservative talk show.
Exactly.
There is.
Exactly. But I feel like if I want to keep updated on whatever conservatives are mad about that moment, that's the place to go. So I guess I mean, Huffington Post is also an aggregator of news, right? And it has liberal op-eds.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the way it started, right? Huffington Post was supposed to be the anti-Drudge.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
And it does raise a question. I was kind of curious what you guys think. Like, I don't think there really is an anti-Drudge. I don't really think there is such a thing.
I think the Huffington Post was pretty close until the whole AOL bottom up. And, you know, now they're going through some growing pains and, you know, things are changing.
But doesn't Huffington Post have some op-eds, maybe from crazy liberals like Alec Baldwin or somebody, you know? But there's articles and kind of some stuff on Huffington Post. Like, Drudge doesn't... Old Matt Drudge with his little cute hat. He doesn't create...
That's what I've said for a long time. When you grill on Drudge, I said he's not writing the stories.
Right, I'm fine with that. My question is why is there not a liberal Drudge? Huffington Report.
You know, there is. It's called CNN. It's called MSNBC.
I'm not saying as far as bent. I'm saying as far as just straight headlines and funny pictures about John Boehner looking goofy. And alien abductions. There hasn't been aliens on Drudge. Remember when there were a lot more aliens? I remember going in there and being like, Obama's a socialist. Alien landing in New Mexico.
I think you're thinking of Art Bell.
And why is it... You talked in this email exchange we had that we won't get into.
But the Jeremy printed off for reference.
The conservative outrage, and it's always outrage. It can't just be... It's like your tactic for discrediting a conservative opinion. It has to be their outrage. They can't have an opinion about something. It's automatically outrage.
There's no opinions on drugs. There's no opinion. There's no thought. It's crap. It's crap for conservatives.
Here's where the outrage comes from. Ann Coulter. She ruined it for everybody.
And what's her relation to drugs?
There is no relation to drugs. I'm just saying that, like, she's kind of cornered the market on conservative outrage, right?
Right.
I mean, she's written, like, 17 books on how much liberals suck and, you know, conservatives are better and how everything they do pisses her off.
Right.
And good for her, you know, there's a market for that, and obviously she's making some money off of it, great, but, you know, it's all crap.
And where would I go, other than this wonderful podcast, we have a forum and everything, where would I go for real conservative thinking? Like, I've enjoyed Red State. Red State seems to be a little bit conservative. Like, I'm not looking for another birth certificate controversy. I want to know what conservatives think, or how conservatives really think the world will be better, and I seem to have trouble finding it because I got to wade through all the Obama with a Nazi mustache. Where do I go? Where do you go? Because if I go to Drudge, if Drudge is a conservative website, Obama's a socialist and Madonna's got two kids out of wedlock. I mean,
I don't care
what conservatives are thinking. I care what's going on in the world. Matter to me what conservatives
is Drudge a good representative of what conservatives are thinking?
I don't know.
Okay, you probably don't go there because you're right. You're opposing anything.
I would suggest, and this isn't like right wing conservative, but Reason Magazine. They have a website.
Okay,
and they have a blog.
I'm writing this down. I'll never look at this again, but I will write this down. Reason Magazine.
Yeah, and they're, you know, they're unabashedly libertarian, so
okay.
It's not purely right-wing.
Right.
If you're looking for people to actually think before they open their mouths, that's the place to go.
But I still, where else do you go?
Well, I've kind of sworn off news because it's baseball season, so I don't really go anywhere, but...
You're avoiding the question. Let's move on to the next point.
I don't really peruse the website. I don't mind where you're going. I have more trouble with somebody that would just go to one website, the Drudge Report. It's a beautiful website, and understanding the world through the Drudge eye. But you're not saying you do that, so I don't have any quibble with
it. I have it right here, where I sent an idea after I mentioned the nanny laws in New York, and you wrote back, "Drudge!" That was all you wrote. Like, no.
It's because 2 seconds before that, I checked on Drudge to see what the conservative outrage was.
You checked Drudge. I haven't even checked Drudge.
No, like I'm saying.
For the record,
I heard that story on the New York Times, so...
And that when you talk about the conservative outrage and that aha moment, I got you. Your version of that is when you think somebody got something off Drudge. That's right.
You're right. And I'm understanding. I think we can come to an agreement. When I shout Drudge, I'm making a false assumption that you got up in the morning with your coffee and your styrofoam cup and hit Drudge and said, "What am I going to be mad about? Oh, I'm mad about soda today." But that's not what you did, so I shouldn't assume that that's what...
Maybe we should actually talk about the story for the benefit of our listeners that haven't read it or heard about it.
You can go to Drudge Report.
Mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, has proposed a new restriction on, what is it, high-calorie drinks, sugary drinks.
Extra-large sodas, Slurpees.
Yeah. So he's proposing that they limit the size of the drinks to 16 ounces. And this is supposed... Well, I mean, we've cured obesity, right?
Oh, yeah, because nobody would think of buying two of those when there were three of those.
Well, you know what I thought, and what I haven't heard... Just get all excited about it. Is say you really crave 32 ounces of soda. What are you going to do? You're going to buy two sodas, right? 16 times 2, 32. That is 32. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what have you just done to the packaging of the plastic that you're just putting in the landfill? You just doubled.
Right.
So this whole thing, like, you're gonna buy two, you're gonna get two straws.
Well, and here's the interesting thing too, is it doesn't apply to diet drinks.
Oh, really?
Even though research shows that if you drink diet sodas, you actually eat more and consume more calories.
Well, and not only that, but I mean, the diet drinks, I happen to be one of the people who believe that all the artificial sweeteners are worse for you than pure sugar.
Right.
So, you know, I think we're just increasing the health risk by exempting the diet drinks.
And I wonder if you look at what was really behind this legislation, if it was a company that makes the cups and the straws and the lids.
Could be.
And there was an article, and let me get this out, Rob, for you. Oh, you geez, no, you're taking it. There were drug companies heavily involved with crafting the healthcare legislation.
And okay. There's a link in the reading room.
Yes, there
those
is.
Those that want to read it.
I put it there. But it's the same idea.
Right.
This legislation comes out that on the surface looks like, oh, they're trying to do something, they want to help us. No, it's because somebody who has a big checkbook is financing it.
Right, right, right. And it does raise the question, I mean, the largest question it raises is a Jerry-type question. Is if you get super, super huge and you get some diabetes type 8 because you're like that big and you're in trouble and you have no health insurance in the current society, I have to help you out. I'm forced, I'm mandated to pay for your health care. Like, regardless of Obama, but in the glory days of old George W., I was paying your hospital bills.
Right.
And so, brings up the Jerry point. The fundamental crime there is somebody is essentially coming to me with the use of force all the way to a gun that says, I need your money here to pay for Fatty Patty over there.
And that is wrong. And it doesn't stop with large drinks. It's
right.
French fries. It's any fatty food. It's anything that you can take to extremes. I shouldn't be able to order a 2-pound steak or whatever else you might add on to that.
So why are we so huge?
Because we're lazy, we're dumb, we make poor decisions. There's no incentive. There's little incentive to not be. I mean,
I'm going to blame Bitcoin.
Ooh, I have another culprit.
Right.
I mean, if I had to point the
Jeremy's
finger...
Jeremy's culprit is us people.
If I have to point the finger at one entity, I'm going to blame Bitcoin because they have made high fructose corn syrup virtually free, so it is in absolutely everything we eat.
Right. And it is not sugar, it is some product that they can make.
And you know, I just heard the other day that they were lobbying the FDA pretty hard to change the name of high fructose corn syrup to just corn sugar. They wanted to call it corn sugar.
Ooh, that's tasty.
There have been commercials with that.
But, I mean, if you watch, and I think I mentioned this on the show before, if you watch Food Inc., they go into this in some detail about, you know, the fact that you go into a store with some amount of money and you just count the number of calories that you're able to buy with that money. You know, if you buy junk food with that money, you're going to get 10 times the number of calories than if you just go into the produce area and buy, you know, fresh vegetables and fruit and all of that. So, Rob is excited about this topic.
I'm a little excited. Because, well, why did big corn get so big? Why?
Well, because it's subsidized by the government.
Oh, God.
Well, you can't deny that.
How so? Tell us why, so I can ignore you.
Well, the main reason is ethanol.
Okay, throw out the ethanol thing.
Well, if you throw out the ethanol, then we feed corn to our cattle. And we eat more beef than any country on earth.
But how did the high fructose corn syrup get to be so cheap?
Well, because we subsidize the corn industry.
I don't know if I can quite make that leap.
I mean, I think high fructose corn syrup is cheap because people can make money on high fructose corn syrup. That it's the free market in action. That there's people twisting the knobs on ethanol or whatever else. But
subsidies have been around way before ethanol.
You're right, but if corn syrup costs what it actually costs to make, you know, if the price of corn syrup to all of the other consumers of it, you know, all the food manufacturers, everybody downstream that uses high fructose corn syrup, if they had to pay what it actually costs to make, they wouldn't do it. They would go back to natural sugar because it's cheaper.
Because you're saying that cornfields are being paid to stay alive, whether they have demands for that or not.
Yeah.
By external entities like the government.
You know, if you watch Food Inc., they make the point in there, too, about just the environmental impact of it. Because corn is not an easy crop to grow, first of all. It takes a lot of resources. It takes a lot of the nutrients out of the soil, so you have to constantly be fertilizing the ground with what? Petroleum-based fertilizer.
Woo!
So big oil gets in there, too. They obviously don't want to see a reduction in the amount of fertilizer being used, so I'm sure that they're, you know...
And corn is not nutritious, so...
Indians ate it.
There are more nutritious foods, certainly.
They should call it high maize syrup.
Maize syrup.
I mean, I got a little excited there before you rained on my parade because I paid attention to what you were saying. Usually I just ignore it. I stay excited.
Well, getting back to the question, why are we fat?
Right. Well, I think we're fat because people people have found out that they can make a lot of money by making people fat. That making the same Jack in the Box hamburger throughout the nation is both cost effective and profit making, and so that's why. But growing organic rutabaga,
right?
Is that a car? Or is that a Studebaker? You know, whatever that is, I don't eat that. But you know, that takes a lot of time and effort and is not cost effective. So
right.
The free market that drives towards profit and cheap prices and paying whatever is lowest for what you get will make a society fat. I think
right.
those same people, apocalyptic vision, the same people who are eating the Jack in the Box are then at lunch are going back to their jobs where they're maximizing profits off whoever else it is, whether it's the subprime mortgage. It's the focus on endless profit that makes us chubby hubbies. You know,
right.
Well, I don't think it's just the government. So this is a great example. I think we're finally getting somewhere. Is I think if you're really hardcore, you know, free market or libertarian, you say, oh, it's all the ethanol subsidies. I don't think it is. I think an over reliance on free markets and competitions and making money and capitalism and investment will make you a chubby society.
I think what you're leaving out of that equation is education. I think we've raised a couple of generations of people since the birth of the TV dinner in this country.
TV dinner.
That, you know, I'll go back to what I said before. You go into a supermarket, you buy 2,000 calories worth of food.
Right.
If you buy 2,000 calories worth of produce, you know, fresh vegetables and fruit, it's going to cost you $36. You buy 2,000 calories of Twinkies, it's going to cost you $3.60.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? That's why we're fat.
Right.
And that's why poor people are disproportionately fatter than everybody else.
Exactly.
There's also, we have modern conveniences.
Yes.
That, where we aren't doing the amount of work, it doesn't take the same amount of work to accomplish the same tasks as it used to.
Yes. America fears nothing but inconvenience.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I can't really blame just the... And there's inherent laziness of human nature, too. Like, humans are born to sit around and watch TV. It's just, we haven't managed to clear all the obstacles on our way to 24-hour TV watching.
Why do some people, when they, you know, they're getting out of the shower, you catch a glimpse, you're like, holy cow, I got some Dunlop going on here.
What's a Dunlap?
Belly Dunlop over my belt line.
Hey! Ba-dum-bum.
Play the gong or the Price is Right fail on that too. So why is that an alarm for some people and others? It's, I got more room for Twinkies now. I'm expanding. This is good. I can pack away more. Where's that alarm?
And I kind of wonder, like I'm not super fit, but I'm not super big, and I wonder when my hotness factor is going to just climb through the roof. Like, I think this is going to be good for me, right? Because I'll come in there middle-aged, kind of overweight, but not really overweight, and they'll be like, who's that guy kind of overweight?
I don't know about you, but I hand out Twinkies to every guy.
Right, you're changing the curve, right?
Right.
Yeah, like, look at that guy's love handle. It's not too big.
I'm just laughing because I'm looking at the row of guys at the bar here who,
that's right,
who are all carrying the Dunlop.
Looks good on them. Doesn't look as good on me. I have a jaw thing. Like, I think it might be related to your jaw. You have a nice jaw. You guys have nice jaws. You know, as I start gaining weight, like, the chin just disappears and becomes, like, one, like, pedestal that comes out of my head, out of my shoulders. It's like a large cylinder that just...
Large pin.
Right.
Like Beaker?
Right, right. Yeah, it does look like Beaker. And you kind of wonder where the chin went. Wasn't it there a while ago? No, I've been eating Cheetos. Yeah.
All right. So what do you got on your list to talk about?
Haven't I talked about enough? Talk about Bain Capital.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
I guess to set the stage on Bain Capital for all you news junkies who don't junkie as much news as we do, is Mitt Romney's career at Bain Capital, which was a venture capitalist firm, which pretty much went around to companies and either bought them up and sold them off, or would go the other way and kind of build them up and basically always get their profits pretty much no matter what would happen. They were a venture capitalist firm. And that's how Mitt Romney made his gazillions. And so it's becoming a campaign issue. And just as it's getting talked about, I've been thinking about a part of that whole Bain thing that doesn't seem to get discussed, or either side isn't quite portraying it quite the right way, or in the way I would like to see it portrayed.
Did you say either side is portraying it?
Yeah, okay. I mean, well, okay, so the Democrats and the Obama campaign are claiming this whole idea is an evil thing, and they're doing bad things to workers, the American people, you know, that's their thing. And the Republican side is saying, we understand the world of private sector enterprise, and we can grow jobs, right? Those are the two sides. I think both those sides suck. That's kind of what I'm saying here. Because I think... while I disagree with the Republican side, I think the Democrat side isn't... Hey, Rachel's here! Hi, Rachel! How are you?
Great. I'm doing great now that I came here.
Do you have any political thoughts to share with us?
It has to do with this place?
No, especially not with this place.
How is it affecting your business here? The economy? Sure. How's the business staying here?
Well,
obviously, it's pretty good tonight.
Luckily, good or bad, people drink.
There you go.
They drink to celebrate, and they drink when they don't. When bad things happen, also.
That's what I drink.
So yeah, pretty much that industry does pretty well. And the microbrewing things, we do a lot of good business here because a lot of the microbrew goes down, and people are really into like brewing their own beer and stuff these days.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of business just because of that.
If you want to try the different stuff,
right? Speaking of that, would you like another one of our brews?
Sure, because I'm celebrating.
Right, exactly. Right, it's good times, right?
Yeah.
Good economy right now.
That's right.
That's
right.
We're celebrating. Uh-huh. We're helping the economy by celebrating, right?
Got it.
Okay, so back to Bain Capital.
What were you were asking me a question about?
No, you were well into why you feel it's the views of either side are not good.
Right. So
I think the Romney camp is just wrong, and I think the Democrats are missing the point. I guess is that I don't. In my mind, I want the free market to be like a zoo, you know, with tigers killing rabbits and bears eating fish. I want competition. I want things to be dynamic. I want that to happen. I don't want a lot of regulation. I want businesses to profit and fail. I want all that to happen.
Right.
My problem is that when we equate that to general good things happening, like, for example, as Romney is equating his Bain Capital experience with creating jobs. The point of Bain Capital is not to create jobs. That's not why they're there. That's not what they're doing. The point of Bain Capital is to make money. The point of General Electric is not to make microwaves. The point is to make money. And if that meant killing 500 jobs and make money, they would do that. If it meant adding 500 jobs and make money, they'd do that. It doesn't have anything to do with the job.
Right.
And so what I have trouble with in the Republican mindset is that we feel like this drive for profit or investment will somehow create good things happening. It'll make better health care, and we'll all have jobs, and things will all happen. No, it might make more profit, might make things more dynamic, you might have less bad companies struggling to survive because they're propped up by things, and you might have less successful companies being hampered by regulation and overtaxing. You might have that, but you're not going to have things that a country needs and a society needs. It just doesn't just happen. It's that leap of faith that I don't quite get. And that's what Romney's trading on. He's like, well, I had a company whose main job was to make money off of struggling companies, and so I know how to create jobs. That's just, ooh, that's a leap too far.
Sure.
Quibble away.
I get the impression that the story has changed from the pre-show a little bit.
What did I say in the pre-show? We do have a pre-show. We've planned for hours before this.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know where, but I feel like he's altered the course just a little bit of that.
Well, the beer makes me very clear and focused. And this might be just a trite rendition of the old complaints about trickle-down economics, that if rich people get richer and companies get richer, then a rising tide floats all boats. And I'm just not a rising tide floats all boats, man.
See, I would tend to agree with that sentiment from an economic standpoint, simply because, you know, those companies that you're talking about that make money, that's the engine that drives this car we're all in, right?
Right, right, right.
So without them, we go nowhere.
I'm good with them. Right.
So in that sense, that rising tide is raising all the boats.
The rising tide is an engine. It's driving things. It's making things happen. It's making the world go around. I wouldn't say it's rising all boats.
Well, like you pointed out, that's not its focus.
Right.
It's not trying to eliminate poverty. It's not trying to
exactly
feed the hungry. It is trying to make money.
I completely agree.
But some of that money does make it into those applications.
Right. 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 But I don't think that's as far of a leap. I'll be kind of even-handed about that. That idea is as far of a leap of saying, oh, the government will come and provide Pell Grants and public education, and that will save the society from poverty. Both of those things are equally fantastic ideas, and I don't mean awesome.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
Come on, conservative Jeremy.
Come on, Jeremy. I can tell by the look on your face you want to say something.
Because I've never heard Rob say that. Let me retract that. Very rarely. I heard Rob say that, well, both of those sides are equally bad. Something is in his beer that hasn't been here before.
Okay, so this is how I appear more liberal is exactly this Romney versus Obama camp issue. Is that I think Romney is I think Romney is wrong by saying that his experience creates jobs. I mean, he's making a connection that's almost like a lie. To me, it's more like a lie.
Yeah. It's like him taking credit for the auto industry bailout.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Because Romney's not interested in creating jobs. Romney's interested in making money. He should just be honest about what his interests are.
Right.
And I think
he's relying on the average Joe's ignorance of how business works.
Right.
He looks at, you know, the Joe Sixpack looks at Romney and says, oh, he's a rich guy. He must know what he's doing. He must know how to create jobs.
Right. He must have been the best businessman I have ever seen because,
right.
Like, there's another thing that drives me crazy about just the way the world thinks. I don't know if this has come up before. But you come up with you're driving through a town and you see somebody in a $100,000 house who's working 40 hours a week and you go, that's good. Good for him working hard. And you go by another house by a guy who's working making $1 million a year and he works 40 hours a week and you go, that guy must be working 10 times, 100 times, ooh, 1,000, wait, how many times?
A lot more time.
Ten times.
Harder.
I had to get off my calculator.
Yeah, it was 100,000, right. You had a little zero there. That guy must be working 10 times harder than that other guy. That guy must be 10 times more efficient. He must have been 10 times more prepared. He must go to work and be 10 times more focused. Right. He must come home 10 times more tired than that guy.
Whoa, easy there, Tiger. I've heard that.
Maybe viewpoint. He's just 10 times luckier.
Indeed, which makes me a liberal.
In a lot of ways, that makes me a liberal because I think, well, don't you value hard work? He chose. He didn't have to go into high finance, but he worked. You know, I think good for him. He made $1 million. He's working hard. Guy could be making $10 an hour digging ditches. That guy could be working harder. He could be more focused at that job.
There could be, but it's a choice. You've made some choices.
Right, right.
I know digging ditches is not going to put me, if I do it, unless I come up with a company that digs ditches.
Right, so for Romney, he valued a choice that made money. He chose to choose a career that would make him $1 gazillion. Good for him. Hat tip to you. It doesn't extend to, wow, this guy is a hard worker. He's a good businessman. It doesn't extend to that. He's just a dude working a job that happens to choose a job and be put in a place that...
So that doesn't make him better or it doesn't make him worse in the definition of things, but it does position him in society to be thought of as better.
And I don't think he should be thought of as better, in my liberal viewpoint. He's not better because he makes $10 million and this guy makes $100,000.
I agree with that.
He's not a better person, you know.
He just made choices that made him more money. Well, good for him.
Well, there's nothing about that that's inherently better. Unless you're him.
Right. No, I agree. Just because, a lot of rich people are complete jerks. And if karma were really what it's supposed to be... They'd end up in a ditch somewhere, and their money would go to somebody else who's a genuine person. But that's
right.
Not how it works.
Right, but it's I have trouble with this idea that more wealth and more value, more wealth equals more value to society. And I hear that a lot from a conservative mindset. Well, look at this company. That company made $1 billion in profit. They must be a thriving company. Well, maybe they just pulled the cards right and made $1 billion. I want them to make $1 billion. I want them to make money. I want companies to make profit. But I don't equate that to anything good. It just is.
Wow.
Like when the bear eats the salmon who swam upstream for the whole time and he's swimming. Oh, he's almost there. I'm about to spawn. Crunch. You know, bear chomps the salmon. Is that bad? Is that good? I don't think it's anything. It just is. Right, right. So when Bain Capital sells off $1 million or creates $1 million, that's not a good thing or a bad thing. That's just the free market working. I don't equate that to anything positive.
Well,
it's just bears being bears.
I agree with you up to a point. Like I said, those companies making the money are the engine that drives the whole economy.
Right.
And if you want that economy to donate money to your favorite charity, there has to be money for them to do
right,
that.
Right, right.
So the money they're making, some percentage of that does get diverted into
right, sure.
charitable endeavors. So that's the good thing. The bad thing is those companies are destroying the environment, or they're laying people off so that they can they can boost their bottom line.
And that's fine. I want them to do that. That's what their job. A bear's job is to crunch on that poor salmon when he comes up the stream. That's what the bear's job is. The company's job is to make as much money as possible, no matter what. What I don't believe in is that a consumer who's buying that product is the only check and balance on that urge. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, I don't believe that my dollars and where I want to spend my money is the only thing that can check that sort of urge, right? I think there has to be something else. Now, what do we have for something else? We have the government, which sucks.
Yes, it does.
It I'm sucks glad in we so can all agree ways. On that.
We can. Well, cheers to that. It sucks in so many ways. Let's list the ways. Let's all cheers to the many ways it sucks. But to me, it's the only thing we have that can act as any kind of force. You said giving to charity. If there wasn't any tax deductions for corporations to give to charity, would they give to charity? Unless it would affect the bottom line. Maybe they would if they said,
I think some companies would.
But a company's job isn't to give to charity. I don't think companies should give to charity unless it helps themselves. Companies should just be companies.
I think Rob is doing the altered on Rob tonight.
No, this is the real me. Do you want me to be more liberal?
No, I'm not buying in. I smell a rat here.
Am I not liberal enough for you?
I think I'm
being left. You don't think I'm being... Is this viewpoint a liberal viewpoint?
Something's not right here. That's not right.
Where I get liberal, like maybe you want me to get more left. Okay.
No, I want to be the Rob I come to know every week, not this guy who's saying F charity...
No,
should the bear eating the salmon is just the way it is. And
no, I want businesses to do what businesses do. I want bears to eat salmon. What I don't agree with is that by them all doing that and consumers all voting with their dollars, that it solves
automatically
all
everything
right.
is better.
Old people get health care, retarded kids, get extra services.
No,
because
it's not.
Right.
It's,
but how is that all that... And then you have to talk about fantasies, then you have to go into this extra leap that, if everybody had more money in their pocket, they would give more money to these services, and people would give more money to St. Patrick's Center downtown.
And I believe that is true.
Right. And I believe it's true to a point, but I don't think it would be better than what St. Patrick's Center already gets from subsidies from wherever else.
Perhaps not. But then you have to ask the question, is it worth the systemic oppression that's required to make that happen?
And that's the question of the Midwest process.
And when is enough?
Right. Is that.
Because when a charitable organization has, like St. Patrick's Center, has more money... Essentially, the standard of living of the recipients of that charity goes up. Or maybe they can help more people. But theoretically, you get to a point where you help everybody, and you have excess, so then their standard of living goes up.
Are you worried that the people at St. Patrick's Center are living too far?
No, I'm not worried about it, but... There comes a point when, where does the charity stop?
Well, here's the problem. Charity is only virtuous when it's voluntary.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, if I'm forced to give money to somebody, it ceases to be charity.
Oh, right. Right. And if, I don't think a company given to charity isn't a virtuous thing. There's a calculation there. It's like, oh snap, we made this much profit this year. We're going to get taxed at this rate. What can we give away out of this to make this tax rate go down?
And I'll concede that point to you that, you know, the way taxes are structured in this country right now, that's the incentive to give to charity. It's not because it's the right thing to do. Right. It's not because it's going to help people. It's because, you know, we're going to be able to write this off and improve our bottom line.
There's a non-trivial PR aspect to that.
Oh, right.
Where your company's job is to blow a lot of things up, but you have a poster of the CEO with his arm around some poor kid.
Right.
Usually a brown person from some small country in Africa.
But that part's the free market in action, right? Because that's advertising.
Nothing wrong with advertising, but it's... I'm just saying there's, along with the monetary implications, there are other intangibles that go along with it. And companies go... I've been at two companies that they don't... It's almost strong-arm tactics that they use to get people to join their community funds. So naturally, I don't join those.
I don't either.
Screw those guys.
Yeah. I don't either. And it's a great example because I don't want the company involved in my charity, right? Those two things are separate.
Rob and I agree too much tonight.
No, I perform a service for the company. They give me
more
money.
Bear. We need more bear. All right, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, going to discuss a little bit of listener feedback, and then I'm going to cover my topic. So stay with us.
That's something to think about, though, because the Cardinals are kind of an offensive juggernaut recently. Somehow went in the tank.
They phoned it in tonight.
It does show you about no-hitters, though. They're kind of chance happening. I mean, if you look at the list of people who've had no-hitters, it's not like all-star list, you know.
They're not orchestrated by vulture capitalists or governments, you know. They just happen.
That's true.
Bud Smith had one. Where's Bud Smith now?
Okay, so we're going to respond to some listener feedback that we got from last episode. Our listener Eric had this to say. One quick note. Jerry's definition of property is something tangible, essentially something that can be physically stolen. My definition of property, something that has value, whether immediate or potential. Okay, so what do you guys... My thoughts on that...
Way to go, Eric.
I think you're twisting the definition of property. I think the word you're looking for is idea. And as Thomas Jefferson said, he who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. All right, so Jefferson uses the metaphor of a candle to represent intellectual property. So the flame represents the idea, and I can light your candle, Rob, and I can light your candle, Jeremy, without removing anything from my candle.
It's like we're in church now.
I had a professor who used to talk about that theory all the time. Dr. Manor, I mentioned him before.
And I think it's a good analogy to use to describe how an idea can be transmitted from person to person without subtracting anything from the person who originated the idea. Jefferson goes on to say, Rob's laughing uncontrollably. Jefferson goes on to say, society may give an exclusive right to the profits arising from them as an encouragement to men to pursue ideas which may produce utility. But this may or may not be done according to the will and convenience of the society, without claim or complaint from anybody. In other words, there is no right to this. It's a decision made by the society at large to grant this, quote, right to have exclusive profits from an idea. So his thought was, this is not a human right. This is a civil right. It's something granted by civil government. And I would argue that we are at a point now where we can no longer sustain this civil right.
Why? Why now? Why? What has changed now?
I think technology has reached the point where we can no longer defend this right without infringing upon other rights, other natural rights that people have.
Well, that's a really good point you bring up, technology, because I think we're alive... We've seen this middle ground where before technology, you couldn't really protect the rights because the technology wasn't there to capture it or prove it. So everything was just kind of fair game. And then we got to a point where technology was just good enough so that somebody could make a claim that that's mine.
Right.
And here's the proof that it's mine. And now we're getting to a point where technology is so good that it's making the originator irrelevant.
Yes. It goes from when you used to have to have a medium to convey the content, right?
Right.
So you used to have a physical book, or you had to have a physical record, or you had to have, you know, something to convey the content.
Okay.
And we've reached the point where that's no longer the case. So to go back to the candle analogy, I no longer need the candle to transmit the flame to you.
You send it through the tubes.
You don't have to buy the candle to get the flame. Right? We've all got computers. They're all linked together. Everything's been converted into bits. So I can send those bits to you. I can send those bits to you.
Isn't that also the problem, the yin and the yang, is that somebody can swipe my bits? Like, I can not unwillingly give that, and somebody can take them and say, hey, these are just bits and bytes, and now it is mine as well as yours, whereas I did all the work to put all the ones and zeros in the right spot.
Right. Well, I think all that does is reveal the fact that, you know, that this constitutional right to intellectual property that we've constructed has always been a sham. It's just now, it's become obvious that it's a sham.
I think now it's become more obvious that we need it. You know, if I made a cotton gin and I did it all in my basement and nobody knew how I did it, did Eli Whitney have a basement? I don't know.
Sure, Storm Cellar.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, he could show it to anybody he wanted. Nobody would know how he made it because he did it all his own. But if somebody could just replicate that with a chair replicator from last episode. Yeah, that's a different story because you swiped the ingenuity that old Eli had to gin up some cotton.
But there's another, probably getting off the point, but does it factor in that I want to use this cotton gin just for myself? As I copied right. Rob's cotton gin.
Yeah.
Now my copy, I'm going to use it just to make my own stuff, my own, you know, I'm going to... For my own personal use, I'm not gonna make clothes to sell. I'm not going to make more copies of this one to sell. I just need it so I can have a shirt and whatever else. Is that playing at all? In your theory, you would say no. It doesn't matter what I'm gonna do.
No, in yours, but for me, that makes a lot of difference. Like the open source software community. Like if you're gonna put some open source software out there. Yeah, use it. Go ahead and use it. If you want to add to it, add to it. But it specifically prohibits you from then sectioning yourself off and then selling everything I did as your own and making a large profit.
But then why is that rule okay?
I think it is okay.
You think it is okay?
Right.
Why is it okay? Why is it okay for somebody to arbitrarily lay that out?
Yeah, it's like I'm okay with willingly providing my services to a community and basically saying if you want to take this and use this, you have to be of the same mindset of providing this to the community. That you cannot go take what I've provided or what I have on my PC and go grab it and make profit off it. That's the difference.
Okay.
Like for Jerry, it's just bits and bytes all out in the ether, right? So if you want to take it and use it, well, go ahead.
Okay, well, let's move on to Eric's next comment because it kind of addresses that. One thing you've never brought up in this argument is trade secrets. Many companies protect certain intellectual property that are of specific value to them and would be damaging if competitors obtained this information. The most obvious examples being the Coca-Cola and KFC secret formulas. But pretty much any sizable company has them. Should trade secrets be allowed? In other words, should I be able to receive damages if someone obtains trade secret information and uses it to damage my future revenue? I say yes. Okay, so that's Eric's comment. I say, I'm glad you brought that up because I think this is exactly the model that I would recommend for dealing with the so-called intellectual property. If you share an idea with somebody and you don't want them to share it with others, then you need an explicit contract with that person that forbids them from doing so. And then the whole issue of intellectual property is reduced to an exercise in contracts law.
Sure, I'm all fine with that.
Well, this brings up in the automotive industry. I don't know this firsthand, but I've seen it. I've heard it talked about. There's essentially a gentleman's agreement. That when a manufacturer comes out with some kind of new technology, they essentially have that for a year. They don't patent it. And it's theirs for a model year, maybe two model years. And then the other car companies get on board. You get analog brakes or any other innovation. And it's an oddity to me that, you know, why they wouldn't, because you start to see the same things on every car.
Right. Well, is it really a gentleman's agreement, or is it just that it takes a year for them to, you know, develop it and get it into the pipeline so that it shows up?
I'll try to remember to research and find out, you know, see. But I distinctly remember a discussion or an article, because I had no idea. I mean, it's not something I would make up. But it was like they characterized it as a gentleman's agreement. That's just how the automotive industry works.
I think also to play into this, not so much with the gentleman's agreement, but but one thing I've heard about, like, if you compare and contrast, like, a Ford versus a Kia, this Ford's been in this business since Model A, you know? So they've tweaked the assembly line, the workforce, the technology, how to make cars, the distribution lines, like, all of that through time to figure out, to get to basically the most efficient way that we have right now. It's a very efficient way to make cars, right? We know how to do it a lot better than we did with the Model A. So if you're Kia and you have initial startup money, you don't have to go through that process. You just show up and go like, wait, how do we do this thing? And that's not exactly theft. But that's why you can, I mean, if you want to build a brand new factory and you want to just start from scratch and you're going to say, I'm going to build this sedan. Right. And I know with this technology, I could tell that we're going to sell this many sedans, we're going to have this, and if you just go and build something brand new for that market, well, that's a lot cheaper than changing the, you know, than changing a lot of old stuff, and, you know, so it's not really Ford's fault, it's not really Kia's, you know, it's not really stealing it, right? They're not really stealing the trade secret, but it's biased towards the new entity.
All right, so what do you guys think if, you know, if we did this contract thing, so that every time you went into a, you know, a record store and you bought a CD, you had to sign a contract saying you agreed not to copy it, distribute it via the internet.
That's your, by purchasing it, you are agreeing with
that contract. Right. Yeah, but see, that's a contract of adhesion, which there's plenty of disagreement. I mean, within jurisprudence, there's plenty of disagreement about whether or not that's valid.
Right.
So if I sign my name to something, that's valid. But if I...
Yes.
There's a gray area where I may or may not know that I'm signing up to this contract.
Well, I don't know if you guys remember back in the 80s when there were shrink wrap software EULAs. You know what I'm talking about?
Like, oh, yeah.
You bought a piece of software and it came in shrink wrap, and there, on the outside of it, it said, by opening this package, you agree to the terms. Okay, that was like the end user licensing agreement, right? That's a contract of adhesion. Okay? And there were a couple of court cases back in the 80s, and I'd have to look them up, but that dealt with that specifically, whether or not that was valid. That's essentially what you're talking about. When you go in and buy a CD, you're saying, by buying that CD, you're agreeing to the terms of that contract, even though you haven't signed anything. Well, see, I don't agree with that. I think you have to sign it. You have to explicitly enter into that agreement. You can't just... It can't be implied by buying something or owning something.
And I think it should be implied by just whoever's created the thing. You know, if I write a big novel, you know, about conspiracies in Washington, D.C., for example, and I have it on my computer, and somebody has the ingenuity to go find that, and then sell it to publishers and sell it around the world, make $1 million, I still think that's a theft, even though it's just bits and bytes on a computer. Lots of bits and bytes.
Yeah, that computer's not connected to the internet, by the way.
That's probably wise.
So you think, this kind of, now I'm confused about where you stand on trade secrets or intellectual property. Or it sounds like you would agree that it's okay if you have a signed contract.
I think that contracts, your right to contract is unlimited. Just like the author's right to contract is unlimited. So if the author of whatever it is we're talking about wants to sell the thing, and each individual who buys it, they want to force them to sign a contract, basically enter into a non-disclosure agreement, then yeah, I have no problem with that, because that's between them and the individual buying it.
Now you're talking about buying, but you talked about just taking before.
Right, that it's just all out in the flames. Right, if I give you the flame and I say, hey, don't share this flame with other people, that makes, we're all in agreement there. But you're, this is alternate Jerry. Jerry's even being different.
But if you, if the person you got the flame from made you sign a contract saying you would not share it with other people, then when you do that, you have breached that contract.
That's fine, but before you said, well, I have a flame and it is out with oxygen, and if somebody puts his taper in there and gets the flame, and then goes say, look, I'm caveman, I have fire, and makes a million caveman bucks, that's all.
That analogy addresses the issue that you have harmed the author in some way, okay? That by making a copy, you have stolen something from them.
Yeah!
But you haven't. You have replicated it.
It depends
on... They still have the original.
But the contract says, I'm willing to share this copy with you as long as you don't make $1 zillion on it.
Okay.
That's not the same as somebody just going into my computer and taking my bits and bytes and making it their own.
Okay, well... I think that muddies the waters a little bit. Let's not use that example, because going into your computer implies that I don't have a right to be in your house.
I don't have a right to be on your computer. Right.
Okay. Let's say it's something you've written.
Okay.
But it has entered the public domain somehow.
Okay.
So I am not violating your rights to privacy or property or anything.
Right. Sure.
By accessing that thing in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's,
I think
it's
we're in agreement there. But if somebody buys a CD, I think what we're saying, if somebody buys a CD, that's not in the public domain. That's a contract between Radiohead and you.
I own that CD.
You own that CD, but you don't own the right to say, look at this awesome music I created.
That's the implication, but that's not explicitly stated anywhere. And I didn't sign up for that. I just bought this CD.
Yes, you have the CD. Go rock.
Now I own this thing. I can dispose of it however I see fit.
But you can't say, check out my rad guitar skills and my funny lisp. I'm Tom York. Right?
This is a tough one.
And you're even being more reasonable tonight.
I am.
It's
the broad axe stout talking.
Before you were mentioning more that if the information exists, it exists for all. And I don't think that's really true. Now, if somebody takes that in, or if somebody had the idea of the book, you know, if I write a book and I get to the very last page, and somebody comes along and sees that.
Did you put it out there where people could see it?
It's a question of, like, yeah, is it out there? Right.
I mean, did you set it out in your front yard next to the mailbox with the word free on it, where people could just walk up and take it?
Or maybe here's a concrete
example. Or is it in your basement inside a safe that's locked?
Right.
Yeah, and that's the difference, right?
Here's my concrete example. Like, so I've developed video games before, and I put them out there on the web as developed by me, and they're awesome. They get like 2,000 plays.
2,000!
Right? I'm big. I'm a huge deal.
You're kind of a big deal, Rob.
That's right.
More than I have.
So they suck, basically. But if I feel like if somebody found that and copied it and put it out as their own, I would feel wrong because I created that. Is that okay? I mean, I'm putting it out there as my product, but if somebody does a control C, control V on that thing,
I would agree that you would feel wrong. Because I think I would feel the same way.
But I don't care about your feelings.
On some level. But the fact is, you put it out there in a public place.
Yeah, see, that is interesting. Right. Because I could have created Angry Birds and gotten 2,000 plays, and some Joe Schmo, Mitt Romney, comes along with his focus groups and says, hey, this is a big thing, and makes $1 zillion off it.
Now, you could have put it out there in such a way that each person that played it had to positively identify themselves, and then they had to sign the non-disclosure agreement.
I did not do that with the 2,000 people.
But out of convenience, you chose not to. And I'm saying that's the trade-off. The convenience of making it easily accessible to your audience necessitates it being easily available to your audience.
I don't want somebody to swipe it and plug it off as their own.
I know you don't. Then don't put it out there.
You don't get 0 plays. Two guys will play it. You guys will play it, right?
I'd steal it, so.
we better move on.
Okay. So the last point I wanted to make is that we're sitting here in a bar talking about these topics, and I just think it's interesting that that's how this country was born. You know, that it was born out of guys sitting around a table drinking beer in a tavern, making plans to overthrow the government, making plans to, you know, create a new nation. The Marine Corps is very proud of the fact that it was born in a tavern in Philadelphia in 1775.
And I'll go further, that we're just chatting here, but at some point, you know, guys drinking beer, had some ideas. At some point, they'd say, look, are you willing to take a bullet for this? And it wasn't a nice bullet, you know, with a little pointy tip. It's one of those little balls.
Yeah.
Those balls, I bet, would hurt.
Yeah.
It hurt. I would take a pointy one.
And myself. Novocaine and Vicodin and anything.
Right.
And at some point, somebody said, yep, I'm down with that.
I just think that, you know, this tradition is important and that it's been lost somehow. That, you know, this discourse does not go on anymore on a regular basis. Most people either don't care or they just let somebody else worry about it. But I think if more people were sitting around tables and bars talking about these things, the country would be better off.
You know why they don't? Say it, Jerry.
Why?
Public education.
No! So if we all fired up, maybe this is a cliffhanger for the next episode. I think people don't, because we live in an isolated society. We have Facebook, we have all kinds of stuff. But I think the media culture, our suburban culture, our car culture, allows people to only deal with people that think like them. And it allows them to have opinions that only match.
I think it stopped way before that.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, it goes back farther than the internet. I think television did it. I think television promised to be this, you know, this thing that was going to link us all together.
Right.
And instead, it just became the talking head on the wall, telling you what you should think.
Right.
People don't go outside, they don't talk to their neighbors.
And too many people just rolled over and said, you know what, you're right. I agree with that guy. Right. Whoever that guy is, I don't know who he is, but I agree with him. And
you're right. I mean, it takes
and
a lot
that set the stage. Now the internet, I think, is kind of reversing that to a certain extent, because it's democratized the medium to the point where, you know, not everybody can get on television and be a talking head on TV, but obviously we can all be talking heads. The three of us are talking.
But it also, it can have the reverse effect of only seeking out opinions that corroborate what you already expected.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to the Drudge thing. You know, if you're certain liberals are conspiring to ruin the world, you can go on websites every day that'll say
if you want an echo chamber, they're still available out there. There's no doubt.
That's human behavior, though.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't go hanging, oh, that guy's a real J.O. and I hate what he has to say. I think I'm going to go buy him six beers. You don't do that anyway.
I wrote an essay a couple months ago about Thomas Paine being the first podcaster. And I think that's true. I think
these
that
are the times that try men's souls.
He wrote a pamphlet that at the time was the most read publication in American history. And, you know, yeah, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have iPods then, but that was the equivalent. That was something that was portable. They could make, you know, a million copies of it and give it to everybody, and people were walking around reading it, and it inspired people to think differently about their country.
You're inspiring me right now. I feel a little excited.
All right.
I've never felt so good at the end of the day. Usually I'm tired and I want to go to bed. I'm going to take on the world and take a lead ball right in my arm.
I guess someone else had.
All right, well, I'll finish up here by encouraging the listeners to check out the links we've provided in the reading room. There's a couple of good ones in there. I'll call out one or two here in particular. One of our listeners provided a link to this essay about George Zimmerman, and the title is "The World's Most Famous White Hispanic is Part Black." And that's interesting because if you read the article, they link to the Reuters article that we talked about a couple episodes back, and the fact that George Zimmerman's grandfather, I think, was Afro-Peruvian. So he's got some black heritage in his family to go back a couple generations.
Hold on a second. Is Reuters an okay source for news, Rob?
It has EU and that's German, which okay. makes it A-okay.
And the other one I would call out here specifically is man boards plane without ticket or security check in San Diego.
All right.
So another
be.
Another triumph by the TSA.
Nice.
Guy walked out onto the tarmac at San Diego Airport, got right on a plane. He hadn't bought a ticket. He didn't go through security.
It's like an airplane stowaway.
Just got right on the plane and yeah. So go TSA. We're proud of you. You got any links there that you want to call attention to?
Jeremy doesn't like to call attention to himself and the drug makers.
Seven tall long court. You can get a small long court too, you only have left 7 in it. It's only $1 more, so it's like an extra drink for only $1.
Okay.
The only difference is you want your 7 to match your drink.
No.
Okay.
Good. Come back in a bit and we'll order beer and snacks.
Got it.
Yeah, I don't have anything. You know, I already mentioned the drug maker's hand and the healthcare law. And that's one of the links on there.
Okay. That's... Rob, you got anything?
No, I do not.
Okay.
I've said enough.
All right. Once again, I want to thank our listeners for listening to us rant here in a bar.
You seem to be a little longer when we're out in a bar.
Yeah, we do tend to ramble a little bit more. Oh yeah, very nice. So thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.
Down the streets I go. I stopped down to the Friday night jamboree in Hootenanny. Now when I got down there, everybody was grinning, greased, and gassed. I go to the bar, fill my bartender. So look at here, man. Come on down here. We got down there. So what you want? I want bourbon, one scotch, one beer. My baby since I don't know when. Mr. Bartender, set him up again. Wanna get high, man, I gotta get loose. I want a triple shot of Cincinnati juice. When I get drunk, don't you have no fear. I want one bourbon, a scotch, and a beer. One bourbon, one scotch, and one beer. Take it, some of you folks heard this story before. Then I sit there at the bar. Just me and a Delaware destroyer sitting at the bar. We sitting there drinking bourbon, scotch, and Budweiser beer. I looked at a bar. Stop that. My bartender. I said, look at here, man. Come on down here. You got down there. So what you want? I said, what time is it? He said, the clock on the wall said 2 o'clock. Last call. Woo! For alcohol.
just one beer. No, I ain't seen my baby since almost a week. Need a drink so bad, man, I can't even speak. When I get drunk, man, listen to me. One drink and enough, Jack, you better bring three. When I get drunk, I'm gonna make it real clear. I want it one.